Filmmaker Commentary, episode 28.
Welcome to Filmmaker Commentary, where we give you insights from our favorite filmmaking commentaries. These commentaries can be heard on your DVD and Blu-rays of your favorite movies. We'll show you how you can use these commentaries and apply them to improve your video production and filmmaking techniques. All of this here on Filmmaker Commentary. I'm your host, Reginald Titus Jr.
Welcome to another episode of Filmmaker Commentary. I'm Reginald Titus Jr. I'm here with
Casey G. Smith.
Welcome back, sir.
Good to be back, sir.
So today we are going to talk about The Fly 2, made in 1989, or released in 1989. If this is your first time checking out Filmmaker Commentary, we listen to DVDs, Blu-rays, the commentaries on these DVDs and Blu-rays, and we take gems from that and help you with your filmmaking and your producing of films. We listen to these commentaries, so you don't have to. The Fly 2 had a budget about $15 million, and I got that number because in the commentary he said the budget was about the same as the first Fly.
Yes.
And so that's where that number comes from, because if you look online, you can't find the actual budget for this.
Right, I didn't find it on IMDb Pro either.
But the box office was about, what, 38.9 at the box office?
Worldwide.
So, if we assume this budget was about $15 million and made that worldwide, I don't know. What would you say? They broke even, maybe?
Yeah, I'd want to say about that. It seems like they would have broke even. They probably would have liked to have seen more, but I think they also had, well, less star power.
True.
Going into this one.
This movie was directed by Chris Wallace, starring Eric Stoltz. And Eric, he is part of one of the most iconic scenes in the contemporary history of cinema.
Are you speaking of Pulp Fiction?
Why, yes.
Are you speaking of the hypodermic needle?
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't recognize him at first, but it wasn't until I went through the IMDb and I was like, okay, that's why he looks familiar. Mm-hmm. I've seen his face, but I couldn't quite figure it out. And around that time, he was wearing that long hair in quite a few movies in the 90s. And that hair made a big difference, even though it's very red.
It is. And plus, he has the facial hair going on in Pulp Fiction as well.
True.
A little scraggly, kind of a scraggly look.
The actual commentary. So to me, this commentary came off kind of like a little sarcastic. You have Chris Wallace, and then he's joined by
Bob Burns, who is a movie historian and collector of movie memorabilia.
So sometimes it's kind of snarky. So sometimes you can't tell if they're being honest about what they're saying or if they're just kind of like punching jokes or inside jokes or whatever. It's not very technical at all. You know, I would not recommend this if you're trying to get something out of it.
Yeah, this one is it gets to a point. There's so much banter between the two, it really detracts from what you normally would want out of a commentary. Now, if this was like a separate kind of interview with the two of them, okay, that could be a nice featurette. But for a commentary, it's really tough. It really, I don't think, works that well, because after a while, they kind of tangent off and start talking about Bob's collection. Again, I would have rather have seen it as an actual visual featurette. Okay, if he's collected things from the first film, fantastic. Show me that in a featurette. I would have rather have heard Chris do the commentary solo and talk about, again, some of the technical things, which he talks about some of the production challenges here and there, but yeah, it's a tougher one.
Yeah, it's not good. Then towards the end, they start kind of arguing about, like, who was it that said, I like the old stuff better versus the newer movies that are coming out in regards to this genre?
Oh.
Was that Bob or was that Chris? I couldn't differentiate the voice sometimes.
But
I remember one of
that was Chris, I think. Actually.
That was Chris.
I think it was.
He's like, yeah, I like the older stuff better. It's that's, and my collection is just old movies. I'm like, oh, and, you know, they're coming off as the kind of like the old guys hating on like the newer stuff. That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
As you know, of course things change, but you can't be stuck in one area.
Mm-hmm.
You have to evolve with everybody else. But I understand them. You know, the classics are the classics. But you know, there's some new classics out there.
Sure, keeping affinity. You can definitely have an affinity for what came before, because we stand on the shoulders of those that came before. And not everything new is good, and not everything old is good either.
Right.
You'll find diamonds in the rough, needles in a haystack, whatever metaphor you want to use. But yeah, the good old days weren't always good. Yeah, things change, new techniques come out, there are new sensibilities for new times, and sometimes only time will tell if something is going to be considered a critical darling, an all-time classic, or maybe a cult classic. You got different categories of quote unquote greatness and love.
It's kind of weird, like going back in time and looking at how like the men are treating the women in the movies, and then how minorities are treated. Like usually it's just one minor, in this one it was just one black random doctor, just like really had no purpose at all, but just being told what to do
and getting killed.
Yeah, close up shot too.
Yeah, dying by accident by the security guard, the jerk security guard. Dang it, I shot the only black guy here.
Oh. And it was like nothing. Like,
yeah.
You just committed murder. Like,
yeah. Oh, I didn't get the insect, but yeah.
So, like, the black people are like throwaway kills. Hmm. And then white women sleep with flies and insects. It's pretty bad what they do to women.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I'm like, okay. Well, we can dive into the, thinking about, like, the film itself, like, even like with the first fly. Again, I love the first fly.
Right.
But if you put a sister in that situation.
No.
I'm sorry. Once your ear falls off, say boo. I gotta go. I gotta go.
Run. That's gross.
That's just.
No guy is doing that.
No. No. Oh, no. If the fly had been a woman, no. First couple of hairs popping out.
I think she's a man.
You know, about last night. A little course on your back. And it is something that like that these women like stand by their mutating men. Like, no.
That's unbelievable.
Well, okay, if we didn't mention this earlier, this is familiar commentary, and there will be spoilers.
Oh yeah,
there will be spoilers. So if you haven't seen the film, I do recommend seeing the film to form your own opinion.
Right,
but we are going to talk spoilers, so just want to give you that heads up.
There you go. There you have it.
So kind of jumping towards the latter part of the film, one thing that his girlfriend Beth Logan did for Martin Brundle, Seth Brundle's son, is that she does ultimately call the organization. She calls the corporation to come and scoop him up once he gets too far along, which I found that interesting. That she just, there's nothing more she could do.
Yeah, she couldn't help him. Yeah. Like after that, he's turning into a cocoon. I'm done.
He's pulling his eyeball out.
Yeah, that's what it was. He pulled the eyeball out in slow motion. I'm just like, I think you lost her.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like,
was it something I did? I'm seeing things really clearly now.
Oh man, yeah, she was done. She was fed up after that.
Yeah.
The film, it feels kind of campy. It's got like a B-movie kind of feel to it. Mm-hmm. I remember the movie, and nothing's wrong with B-movies. I watched them a lot as a kid because I didn't know any better. Especially like a lot of the, what was the guy that does Tybo?
Billy Blanks.
Billy Blanks. He had like a lot of movies out at one point in time.
He did.
And I was really into martial arts. I would watch all these movies.
Mm-hmm.
The acting wasn't that great, but I was, you know, you don't know. You just watch the movie for its entertainment
value. You kind of know, but you don't really know. You kind of know. You're like, there's something, it's good enough, but you kind of know. Yeah, you know something slightly off, like, okay.
That's hilarious. Oh, but like from an entertainment standpoint, like there's some shots in here, like when I knew that the acting was off, one of the doctors, they transport one of the, I think it was a dog. Yeah, it was a dog into the other pod or whatever. He's still alive. And then the dog comes out and bites him in the hand and rips his hand off. Then he looks up at the sky like, ah! It was like so over the top. I'm like, where are we? But as a kid watching this, it's entertaining. Like all of this is entertaining. As a kid watching this, it's like, this is an art. This is a movie.
Right.
You know, this is a popcorn movie.
It's the stimulation of the senses. And, you know, this is a rated R film.
Yeah.
So the gore is, and it's coming off the legacy of The Fly. And the director, Chris Wallace, of course, he was the special effects director of the original Fly, which he won an Academy Award for in his company, Wallace, not Productions, but I'm forgetting the name of it.
Special effects company?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember.
But they handle the effects on this film as well. So you're going to, you know, you get the splashes of gore and blood and goo. And yeah, as a kid, you're like, oh man, that's Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But you want to give a little bit of the premise of the film? Would you like me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So one of the things I do appreciate about this film is that it does pick up like almost immediately after the first film.
Yes, I can appreciate that as well.
We actually open up with a shot of Veronica in a lab, not a hospital, but in a lab giving birth. We even see like this kind of rotunda view, almost like if you were at a an advanced medical facility where you kind of have the high rise where people can stand above and look down at what's taking place in the laboratory itself. And she's on a table giving birth. She's writhing in agony and in pain. It's not actually Gina Davis, who they wanted to originally hire, right. But she really struggled with the birth scenes in the first film, just like emotionally. And so she graciously turned them down. They found another actress to fulfill the role. And what Veronica's character gives birth to doesn't look human. What comes out of her does not look human. It's like it's this weird, odd-shaped cocoon thing. Yeah, and gross. So she dies almost of shock very early on. Nonetheless, they cut this thing open, and there is a normal-looking human baby inside. Now, we fast forward like a year, maybe, I think it is, and this baby is now like an 11-year-old or something like that. Clearly what's taking place is that there are dormant genes inside of Martin Brundle, as well as an advanced aging of his genes. And they said apparently his dad had the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they actually named it after him, after Seth. He goes on and he lives in a very controlled environment, and there's always mirrors around him, so he's being watched and observed. He's being injected with treatments, but he is hyper intelligent. He is a genius. He is a savant. He's a prodigy. There's one scene that I remember when I watched it as a kid, where the one doctor is just as fed up and doesn't want to do these tests with him just as much as Martin is, and he shows Martin this maze, and Martin casually looks at it, turns away, and then on a piece of paper literally draws the way out of the maze, the proper angles and all of that, and gives it to the guy. He matches it up to the actual maze itself, and it's a perfect fit, which I thought was, I was like, that's really smart. That's so cool. But he eventually goes on at his fifth birthday. He is now the size of a 20-year-old, smart, somewhat mature, but probably a little naive. And the whole time, the corporation that his father used to work for is the one that has given birth to him. And they have these new versions of the telepods. And anyway, things progress. And of course, he begins to work on the same project that his father was working on, trying to figure out how to teleport flesh, which they didn't know how to do. And eventually, of course, he's the son of Seth. And eventually something happens where his genes...
He starts turning into the fly, exactly. Just like his father.
Exactly. He starts turning into a fly like his father. He escapes the facility with the female scientist that he met, Beth, who was his girlfriend, and he begins to deteriorate. They come across Stathis.
He was there at the very beginning. It was hilarious seeing him, like,
yeah,
even his overacting, but he's such a good actor that it still kind of comes off. It's entertaining, and even though he's kind of overdoing it.
Yeah, I liked when they went to see him at his loft, and he's playing a drunk.
Yeah.
And said originally in the script he was supposed to play like this belligerent, like kind of lost drunk, but he kind of took it and made him like more of an eccentric drunk, which seemed to work out. And so eventually he and Beth run away. He gets a little more info about his dad, nothing super helpful. And eventually he starts to change in such a way where he's not just getting older. Now he's starting to go through those gross changes, right? Pulls out an eye and is literally going into a cocoon state. Beth knows there's nothing more she can do for him and literally has to call the corporation to come and get him. They do. He cocoons again, metamorphosizes into the true form of what Seth Brundle was at the end of the first fly.
Yeah.
Got the legs, got an extra appendage coming out of his side. No wings, but is pissed. And is just killing everybody.
Revenge.
And yeah, goes on a quick murder spree. And this is the third act of the film. Eventually gets revenge on the owner of the corporation. And it pulls him to a pod. Gets his girlfriend to press the button. And what that does is transport him to, and this other guy to another pod. Taking away the owner's good genes and regular human genes, putting them into Martin's body, mm-hmm. and leaving the owner a deformed mess.
So he finds out how to fix his condition, but in order to do that, he has to sacrifice somebody. And mm-hmm. at the time, he wasn't willing to do that.
Yeah.
Until he turned into the fly.
Yeah. It's all bets are off. All bets are off.
With that being said, we will take a quick break and we're going to talk about movies we watched this past week. All right. What movies did you watch this past week?
So this past week, I had a chance to check out the sequel to the original Kingsman film, Kingsman, The Golden Circle, mm-hmm. Which, of course, brings back a lot of the original cast from the first film and adds in a couple of other people to the mix as well. Jeff Bridges makes an appearance in the film. We also get Colin Firth back as well.
How was that? This one compared to the first one?
I like the first one a little bit better, but I enjoyed this one. Some people didn't enjoy it as much, but I enjoyed this one. I enjoyed the performances. I liked kind of how it expanded and where it went. I'm not going to give away any major spoilers, but you can see from the trailers to the film that something happens with the Kingsmen proper organization, which basically they're secret servicemen. And you find out that there's also a version of that same group, but here in the States, and they call themselves the Statesmen. You have this big plot that's taking place, and they have to all figure out how to save the world together. There's some nice little twists and turns in some espionage, as you know, most kind of spy thriller movies have. There's some really cool action scenes and uses of gadgets that are really well done. But you know, Taron Egerton, of course, plays the lead role of Eggsy. We get some nice appearances, and of course the main villain is Julianne Moore, who, man, she's just in so many different things, and she's just so talented. She can play all kinds of, there's some kind of like gory scenes in it too. A couple scenes with the meat grinder are like, oh boy.
I'm kind of liking the gore thing right now.
Yeah. It's a fun action flick. I recommend checking out. It's currently on HBO Go or HBO Now.
Oh, yeah. Is there room for a part 3? Or would that be giving away anything?
I'd say yes, there's room for a part 3. And that's not, I don't think, really giving away anything. Okay. It's, you know, franchise that works is a franchise that works. So, yes, there's room for a third Kingsman.
For me, I rewatched Marvel's The Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah!
I liked it. The second round, coming back to it, like, I just appreciate just how much time they spent building up these different characters and following the villain throughout the thing. And kind of like, he has a philosophy, like he's disciplined, he's committed. Mm-hmm. And even though he doesn't want to do these things, he does it because he has a plan that he has to get done.
He's fascinating. He has a perspective similar to kind of, Killmonger and Black Panther, that you may not agree with the method, but you could almost hear out his message of trying to balance the universe.
Yeah.
And
perfect balance.
Yes.
Yeah, man. That who did his voice? Was it
Josh Brolin?
Just perfect, stellar performance.
And it's super fascinating to, again, resident comic book nerd here, to see just some of the liberties that they take with the character to talk and address that and how they make that happen. But the film spends a good amount of time with Thanos, and there's rumors that eventually they're going to re-release the film, maybe, I don't know, a year or something like that from now. It'll be a version that'll have more of Thanos's, like, 30 minutes of his like backstory in there. Like, we get very little of it, but it'll be like fleshed out. Yeah, I sure as heck would. Okay, so was there anything else from Infinity War that stood out to you, whether from that direction or anything?
It was just a good popcorn ride, you know, and it's like a balance of popcorn and art.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's art. People have put their, and who, everybody of the team of Marvel feels like they're all on board. It's not any renegade CGI artist or anything like that. With that being said, I did notice, you know, when it came to Thanos, like, everybody's going to be scrutinized how he looks and, like, if it's done well. It's like, because if they got him wrong,
mm-hmm.
that'd be trouble.
Sure.
I did notice, like, kind of towards the end, like, some of the CGI fix with Bruce Banner and Don Cheadle's character.
War Machine?
Yeah, just, like, the floating head thing. I was like, ooh, that's bad. But you kind of let it slide.
So here's one thing that I've heard recently, listening to some different shows and commentary, is that there's also something that when you watch something on the screen, something you have to do with the effects, but that when you bring it down and compress it to even Blu-ray and things like that, even streaming, that there is a loss, that some things just can't look as good as they do on the big screen. And I wonder sometimes how effects are impacted.
Yeah. It looked horrible on the screen when I saw it in theater. And then, plus, I'm not even comparing it to how I remember seeing it. Sure. I'm comparing it to the other effects in the movie that I saw on the small screen.
Gotcha.
So it was like, compared to Thanos, it's like, you got these guys just floating around. You know, it's...
Yeah, you can notice that sometimes, I think. Even with Robert Downey Jr. at times, I noticed in Cap Civil War, they kind of... Yeah, the green screen effect, I could kind of see, okay, you could tell it's...
And sometimes you can get away with that stuff because a scene can kind of go, especially if he's just flying around or doing some kind of action thing, you can really get away with it. But the reason they can't get away with it is because they have dialogue and they're drawing attention to themselves. Like, right. You're going to pay now, whatever he said. And I'm just like, we could let that one go.
Mm.
Overall, I just enjoyed it cohesively. Just enjoyed the action. Yeah, it was... Yeah, I really liked it.
Again, I just can't say enough about how much that is cinematic history coming together. The fact is a culmination of 10 years of other films from the first Iron Man to what we got with Infinity War. From the first Avengers when we get the first glimpse of Thanos to bring in the Guardians of the Galaxy, like to tie all that in together. That's unheard of, man. Can't wait for part 4.
I enjoy the comedy, too. Like, when you're talking about the Guardians and... Like, when Thor, like, comes onto their ship or whatever, and then, like, dude's, like, mocking him, trying to be, you know, trying to match his... Are you trying to sound like me? Or how Thor, how he plays... He's not trying to be funny, but he comes off that way.
That's Chris Hemsworth, man.
Yeah.
He has great comedic timing.
Yeah.
And what they did in Ragnarok, they let him tap into that, and he was able to carry that over into Infinity War. And so even with the Russos, they had some collaboration with Taika Waititi to say, okay, we know how Thor's coming off in Ragnarok. We want to make sure we get some of that flavor into Avengers. Likewise with James Gunn, you know, the Russos want to make sure that they, you know, shadow him, say, okay, look, this is how he's kind of being written by Marcus and Mefili, who are the screenwriters for Infinity War. We want to make sure we carry in kind of the similar tones and flavors that you guys have established. And so, but yeah, Hemsworth, man, he's got great comedic timing, and it just works.
Because he could play it up, you know, he could probably turn it up, and it wouldn't fit right, but the tone, they get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And just like little, and it's like these little punchlines, like, later on, morons, because he thinks that's their name.
Right,
you
right.
know, and so, it's they play that well, and this, them jumping from hanging out with that guy and the raccoon, or he calls it a rabbit, come on, rabbit.
Right, like, yes.
And so, going from that to all of a sudden, you know, now you're hanging out with Black Panther, you're hanging out with Iron Man, hanging out with Captain America. It's like taking the best parts of all those movies and just putting them into one movie, basically.
Originally, I saw an article that Captain America actually wasn't supposed to show up until much later on in the film, like not until like the big Wakanda battle scene. He wasn't going to show up until then.
Yikes.
To come in and kind of like do have a big scene, kind of like what Thor does towards the end. Spoiler alert. But if you haven't seen Avengers Infinity War.
What is wrong with you?
What are you doing with your life?
You just don't like movies. That's what it is.
Highly encouraged. It's just a fun film. Even if you're not a Marvel fan. Again, cinematic history, worth checking out. But Cap was going to come in way later. But when when the Russos showed that version, people were like pissed. They were like, where's Cap at? You got to have him in earlier, man. So they had to make that adjustment. But people were mad that Cap wasn't in earlier on. And so they had to go and make that change. And pops in, you know, within the first act. So, yeah. Okay. Avengers Infinity War.
And some of the mishaps, like the when we talked about the glove, you know, they were pulling off the glove, and all of a sudden the Guardian guy is like all pissed because he killed.
Star-Lord gets mad, right?
Yeah. Starts hitting. I'm like, I don't know. Or what's our guy, Doctor Strange? You know, he can use his little magic to cut off a hand, and it would have been good, right? was he even in that scene when they were doing that?
He was. Yeah, he was. Bands of
that's right, because he would open it up and Spider-Man was jumping through like
the portals. That's how powerful the gauntlet is, though. Like, this thing, once you have them all, I mean, like, that is power. I mean, you get the power one first because, yeah, that just takes you at, puts you at another level. And again, even Strange, his own, you know, being able to do the time thing, that's one of them as well. So
Doctor Strange, he was in that scene. I can't remember.
He was.
He was in that scene.
Yeah, because they were all in the same little.
What was he doing? Did he have like lassos on?
Yeah, he had some bands. Like, okay. Chains kind of trying to holding him, okay. Trying to help hold him back and kind of binding Thanos.
Got it.
Yeah, everybody was.
The glove is going off, I was like, why can't he just do the little portal thing, cut the hand off, we're rocking? Because he showed earlier in the film that's possible if that thing cuts off on you, because remember that the little gremlin thing that he sent in Antarctica, whatever, tries to jump up portal, the portal closes on his hand and comes off. So it was like little things like hold on, if it's that easy, can't you just cut that arm off a little bit there?
Yeah, but Thanos' weight, what
that's just a little
sure, Thanos is really, really powerful. Mm-hmm. Point taken. First scene against the Hulk, he literally like concusses the Hulk. Like, hand to hand.
Let him have his fun.
Punks the Hulk without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And they said they had to establish Thanos as that powerful.
I'm glad they did that because they established it quickly, because even against like a Thor, you know, it's like, yeah, you're going to have, because he goes toe to toe with the Hulk quite a bit. So for him to knock down Thor like that and then beat up Hulk a little bit, it's like, wow.
And was going to kill him, like straight up, like going to kill him, like no problem. Yeah. And this, you know, Heimdall last minute saving him is something else. But yeah.
So, yeah, by them establishing that right away, it was like, oh, this guy's brutal. Mm-hmm. But also, this is also another thing I liked about him is just how he respects other people in like war or whatever. It's like somebody keeping their word or being committed. So like when the guy, the leader, who's the leader of Star-Lord? Is that Star-Lord. His name? Star-Lord was willing to kill his girlfriend because he gave his word. Mm-hmm. And then Thanos was like, I like him. Because, you know, because he was going to do it. You know, it was just like, that's kind of twisted, but I can understand that. You know, just like how I can understand how he could appreciate somebody being committed to something as dark as that.
He has a code.
Yeah.
He has a code, dark as it is. He has a code. He has principles. So he is a layered villain. He's a layered character. And that people often say, whether it's whatever kind of storytelling, the best villains are those that believe that they are heroes.
Yeah.
That they believe that what they are doing is right. That's Thanos. He believes that what he is doing, he has to do. And he believes it is for the greater good. And especially when he gives a little bit of his story about how he grew up on Titan and what happened.
Or even like the respect that he gives to Iron Man. He's like, you've been blessed with, been cursed with knowing everything or knowing a lot or knowing too much or whatever. And then, you know, they should be, you know, respecting you a lot more than they do, you know, kind of thing. Kind of just giving him his props in a way.
Right. The fact that he had said that he knew about him, that's got to freak out Tony. Like, whoa, this, you know, Tony has ego, but to know that this Titan alien dude knows who you are. I'm like, whoa, these whispers are going about. But it's fascinating. It almost makes me want to go back to the second Avengers movie when Tony first encounters Scarlet Witch and she does this thing with his brain and he has this vision of all these bodies laying out. And that is a precursor. That's a precursor to this, to what we're seeing now and what we might see in the next film.
Well. Enjoyed Marvel movie. It was cool to revisit, but we must jump back into The Fly. So I knew I was in trouble when this movie like first came on, because there's a shot of a helicopter coming in and the shot isn't stable. It's like, it's almost like the operator trying to keep up with the helicopter. It's unstabilized. I'm like, oh, we're in trouble. And then I guess the only reason they kept it because they were able to get it, you know, like a full shot coming in, landing, and it's probably more expensive to do that several times. So that's the only thing I could come up with why they kept that shot. But it was unstable. I was like, oh, we're in trouble.
Uh-oh. From the jump.
Yeah, and you know, I don't like to rag on, you know, filmmakers or anything like that, just, you know, out of respect for the craft. But sometimes you got to call certain things out. And I know with Chris Wallace, this was his first film.
Directorial debut, yes.
And his background, of course, is in special effects, you know, with the Academy Award on The First Fly. And having that opportunity come in and, you know, it's not like he was bidding to be a director.
Right.
Is one of his friends from the previous project, you know, put his name into the hat. And it, under the circumstances that was going on at Fox, the project fell through. They were inserted in. You know, you can kind of see just where his attention was. It wasn't necessarily so much on the technically like telling the story with the camera, because that's a huge thing for directors. Where is the camera going to be? Placement, because that kind of determined your style.
Sure.
You can tell a lot of his him with a special effects background was on getting the good gory shots.
That's true, especially as throughout. You know, there are specific shots and moments where definitely it's going to kind of zoom in close and get that, especially towards the end where it really kind of it ratchets up, mm-hmm. and climaxes and just goes just do 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 just multiple gooey gory shots.
We'll go into like some of the shots that I liked. What I like to do is look at shots in the film. So maybe you, as a filmmaker, you can do this. Even if a movie isn't like, you know, a movie, as we like to say, this is kind of fall into like the B movie realm. There are good shots in the film. And when I'm talking about good shots, not necessarily the look of the film, because it doesn't have a look of like artsy, like the first one did.
More so composition. You
know? Yeah, composition, and how can you duplicate some of these shots? And one of the shots is there's a scene where Martin Brundle throws a wine bottle at the mirror.
Yes.
It's almost like he's throwing it at the camera, but I don't know how they did that shot. And I'm just kind of, I see myself like rewinding it, trying to say, how did they do this?
You don't see the camera in the mirror.
Exactly.
I just thought about that now. I'm like,
And it could be because it's a lower shot. Maybe the camera's lower on the ground and it's going up wide. I don't know, but it'll be one of the things you'll just have to test out to find out how to do that and when would it make sense to do that. So I enjoy that shot, you know, maybe incorporating that one day in one film. Who knows?
And I think the actor, Eric Stoltz, I think he did that like on the first take.
Mm-hmm. There's another shot with them running. And so he's running. Eric Stoltz, or it could have been his stuntman. Yeah, I think it was his stuntman that was running, and like the garage door is going down, and he just hits like a perfect slide right under
Indiana Jones style.
Man, it was perfect. It was like sliding in a second. But I like that shot. I was like, that's dope.
And where it closes, where the other guards try to get through, and they just crash into it. It gives that the effect of it. You're like, oh, he made it. Ah, but they didn't.
Yeah, so I can kind of see when you see like actual people running and they are making an effort at running.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise is well known for this effort of running throughout his film. He just has his own way of running. And whenever you see that, it's like, okay, they're putting some effort into this thing, because getting a grown man to run that is not doing that for a living, that could be some, you could pull anything.
That's very true.
I know a lot of times actors do have stunt people to do the running for them for that specific reason, because they very easily could pull hamstrings, especially if they're not running at those speeds that you expect them to be at.
And just real quick, the stunt double for Eric Stoltz in this film, he did some pretty amazing stunts when he is escaping the facility, like jumping off of ledges and like just straight landing on concrete and doing that several times. That's
another one of my favorite shots. The jump, I call him the jumping stunt man, because that's a perfect cut. He jumps over the ledge and both of his feet are out in front of him as he jumps over it.
Yeah,
and then cutaway shot. He's landing. Now I forgot what they call this. Like is it like concrete or park gymnastics?
Parkour. You see,
is that what it's called when guys are like kind of jumping from rooftop to rooftop?
Yeah, it's called parkour.
And normally when you see them doing that, they land and then they roll right away
to keep them, absorb the impact.
Yeah, and you just transfer roll it. Momentum. There you go. Transfer that energy into that roll to take it off your ankles, because you can break something very easily. But this guy is just jumping from a story or two.
Yep.
Landing it.
Absorbing all the impact into his
and then
knees,
running.
And then,
fast, running fast too, man. I'm like, how
multiple
is this?
Takes.
This guy's a robot. It's not real.
Android.
Another one of the shots that I enjoyed was like the peeling face. When the fly spits at the one of the security guards.
Oh, at the end, and yeah. He starts
ripping his face off. Like, yeah. It's so gross. Like, I don't know if anybody would do that in real life. Who knows? But
well, if you got it's a natural reflex. If somebody throws something on your face and it's burning,
yeah.
You'd figure you try to wipe it off. But you go and you try to grab now your whole face just comes off with it.
Dude it's is like, pulling like he's pulling his jaw off.
Because
like,
he can feel the stuff it's seeping in that deep and he wants to get it out, but the skin's gross. Coming with it. Yeah, that's terrible. Oh, terrible.
But it's perfect. It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
It's terrible and it looks beautiful. And then there's another shot where a security guard is trying to peek out the door to see where the fly is. And the fly is there with the body in his hand, one of the professors. And then as soon as the security guard opens up the door, the fly throws the body at the door. I don't know how you would, but it was like perfect because it was like one scene. I don't know how they pulled it off, but it was convincing. But the decision the security guard makes after that, I don't believe. Like he has a machine gun, fly throws the body at him. Then he goes back and checks out. I was like, where is he at? And then he's just walking around. Like, you just seen this fly throw a body at you.
Right. Like, you're going to fare better. Like, y'all ain't paying me enough. Y'all ain't paying me enough. Who's going to fire me at the end? Y'all going to be dead. I'm out.
I'm out. I'm done. How much are they making an hour in 1989?
Not enough. Not today.
Another, not necessarily a shot, but just like kind of remarks. It's Martin Brundle is at the hotel and he's looking at other flies go into the blue light and kind of get electrocuted in the little fly trap. And then he looks at it and he's like, that light is compelling.
Oh, man.
He was just transfixed on this blue light.
He's going through changes.
Yeah,
he's going through changes. What do you think about the shot where, yeah, the very end where the security guard falls underneath the elevator shaft and the elevator comes down right onto his head?
Oh, man, it's messed up. They were like, I think they went out of their way to make sure they had that shot.
Oh, absolutely. I watched the behind the scenes and saw how they, on the second disc, there's a whole like just documentary feature on how they made different shots from the walking of the fly's legs to that particular shot of the head exploding. They did some test screenings of it and how they filled it with fake blood and they'd come down on it.
That's funny. To me, the effects in this film compared to the first one feels more comical.
At times, yeah. And I think they talk early in the commentary about like the lighting, how things are lit. And they say the lighting kind of changes throughout and they shot it on Fuji film that's supposed to make the blues pop and all that good stuff. But there are times where it does seem a little comical. And I don't know that's because it's lighting wise, it's not as, it literally is not as dark or there's not as much contrast.
It's not lit like a horror film. It's like the lighting is like bounced up because you got all these white walls and things like that. And it seems like they're just, the lights are just filling the room to make it seem like any normal corporate room you would go into. It's not being lit for style. The only time it kind of feels like a horror film is when they're like in the dungeon and you see the little dog, the little mutated dog coming out. That's the only time where it feels dark and horror like.
And aside from when he's in the cocoon, you know, that moment in the
true.
The rest of the time it's so, the lighting is in such a way where it does feel, again, not scary but more like spectacle. To a degree where it could almost be humorous. And that's another thing, like tonally, like the film seems to struggle almost with its tone, because there are times where things are done where it's like, that's kind of like comical, which you know may make it feel kind of B level when you get those mixed tones. It only takes a couple of scenes to kind of pull it that way.
True. And sometimes just from a director, it being his first time, not necessarily knowing how to approach his actors or know about the craft, he relied heavily on his DP to make sure that, that he was keeping things together. And if it wasn't for his DP and hired casting actors that were professional, this movie could have just fallen completely apart.
And Robert Vigen was the cinematographer on the fly too. As far as those relationships go, with the actors, definitely he talked about with Eric Stoltz how just he's a very serious actor. He comes to set prepared, and that he was in character the whole time. in character. And so initially that confused Chris Wallace. But then once he figured that out, he tried some different things in terms of directing Eric that didn't work. And he found some things that did work. That was, he said that was an important learning curve for him. But it seems like even in some of the writing, he talks about with some of the writing that some of the actors were concerned with how some of the lines would be delivered, especially with like Lee Richardson, who played Anton Bartok, you know, the antagonist in the film.
Right.
He had some lines that when he read them in the script were going to be really over the top. And so he found, he tried to find ways to deliver some of those lines where they were less just campy. And then sometimes he did go there because it was supposedly would work for the scene or the moment. But yeah, so there were some potential issues with the dialogue.
Gina Davis, they asked her to be part of it. We talked about that. Just her being able to bow out gracefully. You know, mm-hmm. if somebody's asking you to be part of a project and you're not necessarily feeling it or don't want to be involved or whatever the reason may be, but you, at the end of the day, you have to say no. So figuring out a way to gracefully say no without being a jerk.
Yes. And that could be a very powerful thing, because to say yes to something means potentially missing out on something else. And knowing that, okay, she had done her part in the first fly, and which is great, and you know they're able to find somebody else, and her scene's fairly quick for that character, and so yeah, I think it was good that she wasn't in this one.
Yeah, and the reason she gave to me kind of was a big yes.
Well, I mean, like,
because in the documentary of the last one, mm-hmm. she was talking about how during the birth scene, I'd rather have my director there to help deliver the baby. Because the director, he came in and she was like, well, I trust him to do it. So she seemed like cool, like about the whole scene and everything. But the reason she gave in this one was she had issues with it. So,
well, here's the thing, though. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe affirms it, because the reason why she said she turned down the Fly 2 because she struggled with the birth scenes in the first Fly film.
Meaning, like, struggled, like, not with the performance, but just it doesn't make sense.
Or like, it was difficult for her to do, emotionally mm-hmm. difficult and challenging. You. And so maybe that's why she had the director there mm-hmm. to coach her through it, you know, because she trusted him.
Right.
And, of course, on camera, she's going to say, it was great, had him there. But maybe emotionally, maybe it was very difficult. I don't know what she's been through, in life.
True.
Okay. So, yeah, I, to me, that kind of
maybe I retract reinforces that, Gina it. Davis. I retract.
I'm just.
We are talking about birth here. I've witnessed four. It can be traumatic for all of those involved.
Well, life lessons, kids.
Life lessons.
Life lessons.
Learn.
The more you know.
Part two, working with kids and animals can be rough. So there's a shot where there's a young kid and a dog. It's a wide shot. He's not cutting away. But it can be hard to keep kids engaged mm-hmm. into remembering lines. And you can't get frustrated at them. You get frustrated about them, they're done for the day.
Done.
And then on top of that, you have an animal who's like, they might as well be children as well.
Well, some, animals sometimes can be trained. Sometimes they're not. I mean, obviously they worked with the baboons on the first fly, man, which they couldn't train.
That's bold. But that was bold.
Yeah, that was. But with dogs, typically they can be trained. You got some dogs that are, that's what they do. Like, they act. But they said the flies were the hardest ones, because you have that scene where he puts his hand up to the glass and the flies kind of swarm around the glass where the handprint was. So there,
I would have put second unit on there. Y'all figure that out. I'm gonna shoot something else.
Yeah. So, speaking of that, like, second unit, there's a quote that Chris made that he said he heard from somebody that directing movies is like being pecked to death by sparrows.
Depends on how you looked at it.
Yeah.
Or it could be like being petted by angels.
Well, he said that because, going from just being the special effects guy, now being the director, so many people are coming to you asking for your input on so many things. Like, what about this? What about this?
And you got to have
him,
that.
He said for him, it's that first time experience.
I bet that was overwhelming for him.
Yeah.
And it seems like he built up some respect for the position mm-hmm. because it's very easy to be like, you don't do nothing but tell people what to do. Yeah. That's very important, because you got to tell them to do the right stuff.
Exactly. You got to have a plan, have a vision.
Because the people will do it, because mm-hmm. they're being paid to do this. So, okay, you want red lights? Okay, we'll do, like, they'll do it, but you got to have a vision, and that's big for actors.
Yes.
Working with a director that has a vision for what they're trying to do and know exactly what they're doing and how they're going to execute it. Then they feel like they trust you more when you have that vision and know where you're going with this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think he found his respect and kind of like, okay, let me go back to my world. Also, he had his company, which is a special effects company, work on this project. So even though, because I think our guy, the archivist,
Bob,
said, hey, you were responsible for special effects too, huh? You were leading that department. He said, no, I wasn't actually leading that department. I was, my company helped produce the special effects. Right, that would be impossible to do.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you've seen behind the scenes is how much time they took to create these different effects. Even something like the fly at the very end. Because, you know, in this one, we see that full-bodied fly move around quite a bit towards the end of the film. Whereas in the first fly, we literally only see the full-bodied fly momentarily. It's pretty quick. Even like the rig they made for the walking of the legs. Because they have the legs where they're... I don't know what you call those kinds of legs, but the insect legs where they're kind of inversed almost. And they show the rig that they prepared for that, where somebody kind of had their legs inside something like that, walking along for a guy and for a girl. And it was, you know, it's all practical. And so it's pretty complex. And even at the end, trying to pull Lee Richardson's character into the pod because he had hip replacement and apparently couldn't walk backwards. And so they had to have him kind of partially on a lift as it kind of carried him up the steps, and they're just showing the shots of the feet doing that. Yeah, they put some time into that. So yeah, there's no way Chris Wayless could have done all of that, but his brother, I believe, is also a part of his production company. So he had people he could trust to carry those things out. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, kind of you mentioned earlier, you know, having a production team, or if you have any other organization you can incorporate into your film, that could be a plus. And that's similar to what Tim Miller did with movie Deadpool. He had his effects company.
Rightfully so.
Handled they special effects on the first Deadpool.
That's a contemporary film that was a surprise.
Indeed. It was.
That was a happy surprise. There's a scene where Daphne was playing the girlfriend to Eric Stoltz. Beth Logan. So they're dancing, you know, to this Katie Lang song. They're doing this over and over again. And so by the time they get into post-production, they can't, other musicians can't replay it or play something differently. They're just so used to hearing this song, they're like, okay, we just have to get the license to this song. Like,
hey.
I guess when you have, if it's baked in, your brain kind of gets used to hearing it, and it doesn't, any other music, no matter how great, will feel right with it. And I remember, who's our lady director that did Monster? She also did Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Right? Did she do Wonder Woman? Yeah. She did Monster.
Yes, yes. Oh, man.
Dun, dun, dun. So sorry.
Wonder Woman was directed. Patty Jenkins.
Booyah, Patty Jenkins. They talked about it in Monster when they were at the skating ring, and they're kind of going around, and it was like a well-known song that was playing, and they just really, really loved the song that they had to actually find their I can't remember the name. It was a very popular rock song in the 80s.
Oh, Don't Stop Believing.
Yeah.
By Journey.
So that was playing, just worked perfect with the scene. And so they had to figure out a way to get him to be okay with putting it on song. Because they didn't really have a budget to put into that song or buying the license for that song.
So and then he became a producer on the project too.
Booyah.
It also happens sometimes even like with animated features, like with The Incredibles. Like some of the people who worked on the film just put in filler voices for some of the characters. But then sometimes that ends up working so well, they end up, instead of hiring a professional voice actor or a celebrity, wind up staying with them. And then you get Brad Bird playing Edna Mole, and you get Brad Bird's son playing the little kid outside of the Incredibles homes when you know,
oh, that was he the sees, son?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't voicing. Know, something incredible, I guess. Or awesome. Right? Did you say awesome?
Something
I guess.
That's fun. That's real fun. But you get those moments, and so you'll find in different Pixar films, different people who are involved with the production, that their voices just.
I can't wait to do an animated feature.
Yes,
got to.
Indeed.
Soon, very soon. Learn from your actors. That's also another thing. And you talked about it with Eric Stoltz, just how technical he was. He's a very technical actor. Mm-hmm. So he has his own strategy on how he wants to do things. And Chris Wallace, being, you know, new to the game, you know, learning from the actor and how to approach him, because it said they disagreed with a couple of things. But headstrong actor like Eric, it probably makes sense to kind of lean more towards his way sometimes, just because he's been living with this character literally. And can tell you more about the character than anybody in that whole building.
Exactly. And the fact that he said he was in character the whole time. It's very method. I don't know how you do
that's
it.
That's next level. That's,
yeah, that is next level.
Do your one of the last points is, as you alluded to earlier, is like just doing your role on the film, just doing that with excellence. And when you do that, new opportunities will arise. And that's basically how Chris Wallace was able to get this opportunity. Even though he didn't really was bidding for this job.
Yeah, just being somebody who produced quality work. And, you know, people often say that luck is preparation meets opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, he worked at his craft and stayed prepared. And, yeah, opportunity came up. He was the next man up. You know, one of the things that he mentioned as a first-time director that there was a lot of nervousness around shooting the love scene. And you'll hear directors talk about love scenes and how awkward they could be. And it said that Eric showed up wearing a leather outfit and had whips just to kind of break the tension before the love scene. And he said, you know, it kind of broke the tension with the actors, and it was a closed set thing. But he still was a kind of a nervous wreck about it, still felt uncomfortable. One homage scene, because, you know, often when you have a sequel to something, they may kind of do a callback or an homage to something else. So, you know, we see things like, again, the vomit spit melting things on people.
Right.
But we also see a callback to the full-bodied glass breakthrough. You know, in the first Fly,
yeah, that's true.
It's while she's in the hospital. He's still in a humanoid form. In this one, he comes through like a
top floor or ceiling of the...
Yeah, like
not the lobby, but that little dungeon thing they had.
Yeah, he kind of just psh, like a lattice. He kind of just breaks through, and it's a full body thing. I'm like, okay, I see the callback there. But that was a nice little homage piece that they threw in there.
And it's almost honestly, it's almost the same movie as part one, almost.
Yeah, you have the love story, you have the experimentation, you have bar talk there.
You got to show the strength. So it's got to be the scene that kind of shows how strong he is. So that's him throwing the security guard through the window. It's like, I'm stronger now. I'm stronger than you.
Mm-hmm.
It has him shook for a couple of scenes. Of course, the courting. You know, how does this little kid get from to the point to, like, not knowing anything about women to, like, there's a sex scene. Who, what girl is this? That's oblivious that this guy is. Like, it seemed like everybody would know this kid is living in that place. You know, they all work there.
Yeah, but it's clearance. They talk about that all the time. True. Level clearance. True. I don't have clearance there. So it's a facility where they got money, where they've got secrets.
Yeah.
They've got secrets.
Secrets. So that part. So you got the courting. You got the part where it shows strength. You got the vomiting, the gross part. He's going through the whole cocoon stage. Like, it's almost the same.
A lot of similar beats.
It's happening all at one location for the most part.
Yeah, not a whole lot of scenes. And again, I you know, the pacing of the movie, it goes by quick.
It's entertaining.
There aren't any slow scenes. Like, when I watched it again, I was like, oh, yeah, this just moves. They don't waste time.
They don't. Know?
There are a couple, like, I'm trying
to remember. Some of the editing was off.
Yeah, there was one cut I was like, oh, that was abrupt. Where I'm trying to think.
The timing was off. There was one shot where he's saying bye to Daphne, Beth Logan, mm-hmm. He's saying bye to her, and the security guard is like coming behind him. But I think the way they were introducing that security guard was like surprising. Like, he just comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But in one of the shots, you can kind of see him coming a little bit, and then they cut to her like waving. But she doesn't react to the guy that's walking towards him. Yeah. And so it almost seemed like that was like a 1 second that was just like kind of misplaced.
Mm.
And then they cut like as if it was a surprise that he runs into the security guards. Oh, saying bye to your girlfriend. And so it was like a weird little cut there. There was a couple of those where the editing didn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of there's one scene in particular I remember seeing where it seemed like it's a really abrupt cut, but I can't think of exactly where it was at. One thing I'll mention is fascinating where when you're in a location and you have maybe you work with local casting agents to find local talent, because the guy who played the security guard, he said he's a real nice guy in real life, and he's actually a comedian.
Yeah.
He's a local comedian in the area, and just...
He pulled it off.
Yeah, came in and did his thing. Very believable as an unlikable douche. So I was like, wow, kudos to you, guy. You did your thing.
I would recommend this film from a good B-movie. Mm-hmm. It's a good B-movie. It's entertaining. As a movie, it does its job. It entertains you. From a technical standpoint, on the commentary, there's not really much there.
No, there isn't.
But if you look into the special features, you can glean a little bit from the special features, especially if you're into special effects and things like that.
Especially if you're into practical special effects. Yeah. And again, it's decent. It's, mm-hmm.
It's a decent film. B minus.
Ooh.
C plus.
Woo. It's dropping. Ooh. It's cold in here. Steadily dropping.
What did the professors call that? It's like a moving average. It's like, ah, whatever I feel like.
Your average is falling off the ladder. He's like, ah. Free fall. This is a free falling average.
C minus.
Keep it up. You just keep it up. D plus.
I like part one better.
Oh, yes. No disagreement here.
Yeah.
The first fly definitely is much better. But I think it was worthwhile coming back and revisiting. Sequels are difficult. It's very difficult to top a successful first film.
Yeah, I don't think you could have topped that first one, but you could have you could turn it up a level. You could put more money into it and try to keep the same people involved. So if Cronenberg would be interested in doing a part two, keeping the same people together, and then that script had problems.
Yes.
You know, he mentions it in the commentary, so he didn't really, you know, he gets all the blame, you know. As a director, you're going to get all the blame, so you just got to accept that L. And if it's successful, you accept all that as well.
You get the cred.
Yeah, so you got to, yay. That's part of the game. That's what you signed up for as a coach.
They mentioned they cut out quite a bit of dialogue to keep the pacing. There's a lot more dialogue that's supposed to be in here. And they cut a lot out so they could keep the pacing, which I'm glad they did, because I'm like, there wasn't much to say.
There's not much you can do here. Next week, we are going to talk about the movie Unbreakable by M. Night Shyamalan. Shyamalan.
Yes.
Sorry, I told your name up. But I'm sure not the only one. And the reason that I'm interested in that film is because, you know, I was unaware that
Shyamalan,
he's dropping all these movies, but I'm just unaware that these are in the same universe. He's just not on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
I am a fan of his, watched a majority of his movies, but just he hasn't been on my radar of lately. And so once I found that out, and then of course he has a new movie that's dropping, I'm like, all right, he is a true artist.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of these storytellers. He has a style. You know, he's a writer director. He takes his time. Actors love working with him. He can draw in talent like Bruce Willis, like Samuel L. Jackson, our guy from Split. Yeah. So he's able to pull these people in that want to work with him. So it's like when you get that many people that are serious about their craft, God, man, you can really pull out some fabulous stuff.
Yes. I from the first time I saw Unbreakable, I enjoyed it. Look forward to revisiting it and listening to his commentary on it.
Tune in next week as we dive into Unbreakable. Thank y'all for tuning in. Also, if you're interested in future episodes, go into SoundCloud, check us out there. Stitcher, we're there on iTunes. And if you have a movie that you would like us to listen to the commentary, review, get our point of view on it, feel free to drop us a line on our facebook.com/filmmaker commentary or on SoundCloud. We appreciate that. Leave a review on iTunes because that helps us out as well. And we'll see you next time. Peace out.
Peace.